All right, this is the last formal class on the Lamrim, Steps on the Path, the spiritual path from beginning to end. And then we'll meet tomorrow afternoon for discussion. I encourage you to put your questions in the box as soon as possible so that we can go and find the answers on the internet. I'll do a little review first, but tonight's session is the jackpot. It's the grand finale because it's on the sixth of the six perfections, what are called the six perfections, which is the perfection of wisdom, prajna in Sanskrit, prajna, which is the jna in prajna means knowledge. And that J-N-A is kind of hard to say in Sanskrit, just like the G-N-O is hard to say in English when you say the word gnosis, gnosis, right? Or when you say the word knowledge, K-N-O. These are all related, actually. So they mean the same kind of, they're in the same semantic universe. So the Sanskrit is related, it's one of the root languages of English, actually. So there's lots of synonyms. So in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, one of the great masterpieces of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, at the beginning of the ninth chapter, where Shantideva, the author of the text, begins his presentation of the perfection of wisdom, he says, as does Atisha, as we'll see, you know, everything that has come before, all our practice, all the practice of ethics, all the practice of meditation, all the practice of giving and patience and joyful effort, it's all in the interest of wisdom. It all comes down to wisdom. So, you know, you can create the karma, you can create the momentum through, you know, doing good deeds, watching your morality, meditating, you know, doing all these practices, yoga. But it's wisdom that will save you. Not practice, not karma, but wisdom. It's wising up to how things really are that will bring us into the full, you know, kind of goal, the full goal. So on the way to the full goal, you know, we have a better life. That's good. It's good to create good karma. Better than bad karma. Way better. More pleasant. And it's good to have a happy, good life. But the way to achieve the final goal, the goal of permanent happiness, bliss, you know, Buddhahood, whatever you want to call it, is through wisdom alone. So tonight's class is kind of important. It's kind of important to try to struggle with what wisdom means. Wisdom means that things are not what they appear, okay? And we're very attached to how things appear, right? I know some of you are kind of new to this, so we'll go as slow as possible. But you know, it takes a long time to penetrate the veils of illusion, even intellectually. And you know, and that's not the final end. The final end isn't to get really, really smart about, you know, what they call emptiness, the absence of things being the way they seem. That's not the point. It's not the point to go from, you know, this class back to Melbourne and impress all your friends with how clever you are. You know, watch me disappear this glass, you know? And then you start talking about emptiness. Oh, there's no glass there. Oh. That's not the point at all. The point is to try to understand it intellectually so that in contemplation and meditation, you have a realization. I like that word, realization. It becomes real. The reality of things becomes real. And that takes a long time. It takes a long time to even get an inkling that we are living our whole lives deluded. So that kind of, like, sometimes they say, you know, when you hear things like that, one of two things happen. One, you get scared, maybe. you get frightened. You say, wait a minute. You mean everything I thought that was real isn't real? And you say, yeah, that's right. Everything you thought was real isn't real. And so some people get scared. Then other people, depending on kind of like where you are in things, other people get a shiver up their spine. Go, ooh, oh, wait a minute. So tonight will be things that make you go, a little bit, okay? And you know, if you're new to this stuff, just relax, you know. It'll all be over soon. Sort of like going to the dentist or something like that. Just relax. Don't take it like... See, the whole point, actually, the whole point of studying what they call emptiness is to not take things so seriously. Because they aren't real in a certain kind of a sense. They're just not real. They exist in an only a dreamlike fashion. We are living in a reality that has only a dreamlike existence. This is what they call maya in the Sanskrit text also. Illusion. It's like an illusion. It's like going to a really good magician. You ever seen a really good magician? You know, or if you haven't, I think they've got on YouTube, they've got like YouTube things of David, what's his name? Copperfield?
Blaine.
Huh?
David Blaine?
I don't know. Yeah, well, you know, he's whoever it is. Who can like, you know, like make things appear out of thin air and, you know, right? There was a couple of magicians who used to work in Las Vegas who could materialize tigers, like in, you know, just out of nowhere, and all of a sudden the audience would be like confronted with these big tigers, you know, like out of nowhere, like pulling a rabbit out of the hat, you know, see, like that. And what we call reality is like that. It's like a magic trick. It's like living in a magic trick, only you can't figure out how the magic's done. All you can figure out is that it is magic. You can get an inkling that it is magic by proving that it can't exist the way you think it does. The way we think reality exists is totally impossible. So that's kind of like the reasoning, the logic, the intellectual kind of wrestling that we have to do with trying to get some wisdom, is to get this kind of uncertainty, this kind of agnosticism about how we think reality is, and have that kind of being shaken, you see? Have that kind of that certainty that we have to be undercut a bit. That's the beginning. So I like to think of it as like when you have a sweater, and it has like a woolen sweater, like a jumper, woolen jumper, and it starts to get a little loose thread on it, you know. And so tonight we'll start picking at the thread of ignorance. See that? And it takes a while to unravel the jumper of ignorance, but little by little we'll start picking away at it, you see? So tonight for some of you it'll be like your kind of first pick. For others of us it'll be our 100,000th pick maybe, or 500,000th, but it's still there, the jumper's still there, so we have to pick some more over and over and over again. You've got to keep picking at it. And little by little, because the truth is the truth, eventually we have to discover it. Can't live in error forever. That's the good news. Could take like, you know, thousands of lifetimes, but eventually we're going to get it. And when we get it, we'll be awakened. We will realize what has been there all along. We will realize reality and no longer live in the illusion. We will wake up. We will wake up from the dreamlike existence. And waking up from the dreamlike existence doesn't mean that the dream just goes away somehow. See, the dream still stays, but you're lucid in the dream. You ever had a lucid dream? You know what that is? Like when you know when you're dreaming and you know that you're dreaming? Yeah. So we will always live in the world of appearances, the world of form, the world of appearances. We always will live there, even after enlightenment, even after awakening. But the difference is that we'll know that we're dreaming. And you know, if you're lucid when you're dreaming, the dream can't affect you in the same way, right? If you buy into the dream, then like, you know, you get scared and you know, like cry and scream and, you know, all kinds of terrors happen. And, oh yeah, right? Because you bought into the dream. And then you wake up and it's, oh, was only a dream. But if you're lucid in the dream, you know it's only a dream while it's happening. And that's wisdom. Wisdom is understanding the dreamlike quality, but not being taken in by appearances. You see, not being fooled by the mere appearances of things, which cannot exist the way they seem to. Okay? That's a little prelude. So let's do a quick review. What's the first step on the path? Before you even get on the path, what's the first step? Yeah, some form of renunciation. Of saying like, look, I want a different kind of a life. I'm going to try a spiritual path because the other paths haven't worked out. Then what? Yeah, find somebody to teach you. Get some teachings, you know, like learn. Learn like how to live differently. Then what next? Appreciate the opportunity that you have to learn and to practice, right? Leisure and fortune. Then steps shared with those of what they call lesser scope or foundational scope, which is defined by, I want to be happy in this life. Okay? With the first person pronoun, I want to be happy, and the this life, in here and now. I want to learn how to be happy in this life. And then, so in order to be happy, number one, I have to realize that this life won't last forever. Death awareness, right? And then to think also like, well, you know, the kind of life I have here isn't guaranteed to me forever either. If there are, you know, future lives and stuff like that, it may very well be quite different than this. Okay, some good, healthy fear. I mean, a lot of the basic things here is driven by fear, actually. Fear isn't always a bad thing. You know, like if you touch a burning stove and you get burned, you have a little fear about the stove from then on, right? Which helps you not get burned again, right? So fear can be useful. Healthy fear. So to have some healthy fear about the fact that, you know, this life won't last forever and that what comes after this life is unknown to us, actually. And so we better kind of like maybe take out some insurance policy and try to live a good life in this life just in case, you know, there's something after this life. Then the third one is going for refuge. What's going to help me? What's going to help me live a good life? What's going to help me live a life that in which I can be happy in this life? And, you know, traditionally, refuge means that you think about spiritual paragons. Is that the word, paragon? Paragon, I think, is the word. Models, you know? And say, like, well, you know, how did Jesus live? How would I live if I were trying to be a Buddha? If I was trying to live like Jesus, or I was trying to live like Mahatma Gandhi, how would I live? So they provide models, role models, you could say. You know, that's the Buddha. Then the Dharma, like you learn the spiritual truth, you know, from all the different kinds of sources that we can. And then the Sangha, hanging out with people who are healthy to hang out with. If you can't learn something from them, and if you can't help them, what are you doing hanging out with them? Okay, it's kind of a test as to whether or not your relationships, your friendships and so forth are useful or not. Can you help other people? Can you help your friend? Can you learn from them? And if you can't do either one, what are you doing with them exactly? That's the Sangha, taking refuge in the Sangha. And the last one is karma, which we've talked about a lot here. Okay, very, very simple. You know, karma is not complicated. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Okay, period. Full stop. That's all you need to know. Just start acting in the world vis-a-vis others as you would want them to be acting towards you. And then you'll be all right. See? You don't have to know like big lists of 10 of this and 14 of that and 35 of this. Just, you know, treat other people the way you would like to be treated. And generally speaking, that's all you really need. Then the steps shared with those of medium capacity, medium scope. This is the next level, the next jump up. Having a basis now in a spiritual life geared towards not harming others. That's kind of the basis of the first level, you know? No longer harming others so that you can live a peaceful life yourself. Can't live a peaceful life if you've always got stuff on your conscience. Have you noticed that? If you always have stuff on your conscience, you're not living a peaceful life, because you always think, well, you know, maybe I'm going to get found out. Maybe they're going to get back at me. Maybe I'm, you know, somebody's going to take revenge on me for what I did to them and so forth. So having kind of established that basis of, you know, living a life in which you are trying, at least, not to harm others with your physical actions, with your speech, or even in your thoughts. Then the next one is, how could I try to get, see, it's still first person pronoun, how could I get perfect happiness? How could I achieve what they call nirvana, or moksha, liberation, you know, personal liberation? And then the first step here is to really want it. And to really want it means that you know that without it, there will always be problems. Even the best deal in this life, the best possible life that you can lead in this life, is always going to be riddled with suffering until the mind changes. You see, nirvana, samsara is what they call this suffering life, samsara. And nirvana is its opposite. You see? But it's not somewhere else. Nirvana is right here, right now, as a possibility. It's just a different perspective. Okay? So it's like going to the eye doctor. Everyone been to the eye doctor before? And they put that big thing on you, that big, like, fake glasses thing. And they say, which is better, A or B? One or two, you know? Like, keep changing the lenses till they get your prescription right. Well, right now we're in samsara lens. So we see the world like from that point of view, and nirvana is just a click. See, it's not the change in the external world. You don't go to some, you know, Alpha Centauri or someplace and enter the gates of nirvana. Nirvana is here and now as a possibility, but it requires a different kind of a lens, a different kind of perspective. So the first step here is to really want that. To want it means that you know what you don't want, and you also think that there is an alternative, that the human mind is capable of being perfectly happy. But that requires that all mental afflictions be eliminated. The permanent end, the permanent cessation of all mental afflictions. That means no more anger, no more jealousy, no more envy, no more lust, no more greed. So, is that possible? And, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking if that's possible. You know, time's running out, right? So I'd kind of like to get there, at least there. So is it possible? And I've come to the conclusion that eliminating mental afflictions is actually not possible. Yeah. So I guess I get thrown out of the Buddhist club or something like that. But I don't think it's possible. You know, it's certainly possible to dwindle them. Dwindle? To diminish them. Certainly possible. You know, through practice. Through practice, you can make them smaller and less frequent. And you can also make them less duration. So when they pop up, you know, they're not as strong as they used to be, and they go away quicker. That I can speak to from experience, that's possible. But I cannot speak from experience that it's possible for them never to arise. So how is nirvana ever going to be possible? Here's the key, I think. It's not that you eliminate mental afflictions. You eliminate identification with mental afflictions. They are not me. See? The problem with mental afflictions isn't the mental afflictions. It's the identification with the mental afflictions. I am angry. I am proud. I am envy. You see? So they arise. If you don't identify with them, they, just like everything else, they arise, they last for a while and go away. But when you identify with them, you give them legs. You give them some duration, you know. You give them some enliven them, yeah? You empower them by identification with them. So part of this stage is realizing that there isn't an I to identify with the mental afflictions anyway. The I is an illusion. So we'll talk about that a little bit tonight, because that's kind of like, that's wisdom 101 in a way. Wisdom 101 is recognizing that what we call the I is simply an idea. It isn't a thing. It's just an idea. And that idea, being only an idea, needs to find something to strengthen it all the time. You know, it's like we're all kind of in a permanent identity crisis, right? There's a certain part of us that has a sneaking suspicion that the I isn't there at all. And so the ego then sort of looks for things to identify with so it can feel like it's really there. And among the many things that the ego tries to identify with, and the most problematic, are what we call the mental afflictions. I am proud. I am jealous. I am envious. I am all these things that are arising in the mind stream all the time. So the elimination of the attachment and the grasping to the false I, which is only an idea of the I, that's the key, I think. That's the key for nirvana. So then it is possible not to have any mental afflictions because you don't have anything. There's no I to have any mental afflictions, you see? And that's the way to nirvana. Then we talked about some of the steps shared with those of greater capacity, developing the bodhicitta, the mindset of wanting to awaken as all sentient beings. Okay, so the first person pronoun then becomes the first person singular pronoun expands to the first person plural pronoun. Did I get that right? Yeah. We will get enlightened. We will all get to enlightenment. Okay? Radical sort of shift in who you think you are. So having eliminated the idea that there's an individual self in the first place, okay, that's kind of at the step shared with those of medium scope. Having eliminated the grasping to the individual I, you are then in a position to re-identify yourself as the cosmic I, the collective I, the we. Okay? And that's bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the awakening mind to the fact that we're all in the same boat, that we are all the same ultimately, that the separation that we feel is an illusion. Okay? All consciousness is the same consciousness. In some texts they say, like, the ability to be conscious, okay? Not what you're conscious of, but the ability to be conscious is exactly the same in all sentient beings. Exactly the same. It's the same in bugs, it's the same in kangaroos, it's the same in all different kinds of people. The ability to be conscious, okay? Not what you're conscious of, not anything that you're conscious of, but the mere ability. You see what I mean? Yeah, that's universal. See, that's the same in all of us. So with this kind of new radical sense of identity, this kind of universal cosmic sense of identity, you begin the sort of third stage of a spiritual practice. So developing the wish, taking the vow, okay, taking the vow of bodhisattva. I it's hard to even use the pronoun anymore. I will bring all living beings into enlightenment because I am all living beings. You see? And that's a kind of a grandiose, spiritually grandiose kind of a program, isn't it? Yeah. But that's the vow. The vow you take is I'm no longer working for myself because I realize that myself is an illusion. I am working for all beings because I am all beings. I am all beings. Then you start to live the life of a bodhisattva, somebody who has that kind of radically new identity. And then you start what they call the six perfections. The first perfection is what? Generosity. Generosity. Giving. And you can, you know, see how that begins the altruistic program. The altruistic program of living your life as if you were all other beings. So what you have isn't yours anymore. You see? What you have materially, what you have in terms emotionally, in terms of your love, the gift of love, what you have in terms of your knowledge about spiritual life, this belongs to everyone. And it's to be shared equally with everyone. Then the perfection of ethics, which is there at every level, as I mentioned before. The perfection of patience or tolerance, because all beings are just the same as you, so you are tolerant of them. Just as, you know, we're pretty tolerant of ourselves, right? We're pretty good at being patient with our own failings. aren't we? You know, it's like if you went to court or something, and you know, you're the kind of the judge and the attorney and the accused all at the same time, and in our own little courtroom of the mind, and we represent ourselves to the judge as, you know, you have to let him off, Your Honor. He didn't really know what he was doing. Could we plead insanity on that one? And then the judge, being us too, he says, okay, you know, suspended sentence. So we should do that with others too. Should cut them a break. So that's patience, tolerance. Joyful effort, working hard for your spiritual progress. Being stoked about it too, joyfully. Working hard for your spiritual progress. And then where we left off last session, perfection, and the fifth and the sixth kind of go together. The fifth is meditative concentration. And the purpose of meditative concentration at this level of practice, is to hone the mind such that it can penetrate the illusion that keeps us from wisdom. So, you ready for the wisdom bit tonight? All right, here we go. So I think we left off at verse 41 was the last one we did. What page is that, Marie? Page 9. So we'll start with 42. Everyone got it? Verse 42. When the practitioner has achieved meditative concentration, that's shamatha again, shamatha, he or she will gain higher knowledge as well. So all of these siddhis, all of these powers will come automatically with that. But the obscurations will not be destroyed without the yoga of the perfection of wisdom. Yoga is used here as a word in relation to the perfection of wisdom, which means it's going to be hard. Yeah, yoga is hard, except for Nidra yoga. All other yogas. Yeah, it's hard not to fall asleep sometimes. The obscurations. Obscurations means the obscurations to wisdom. Obscurations, you know what that word means, right? It's like something's covering it over. In the Sanskrit, avarana, it means it's like a pearl. Or a diamond that's been covered over, obscured by mud. And it has to be cleaned off. The obscurations have to be cleaned off. You don't have to create the diamond. You see? You don't have to make the diamond. But you have to discover the diamond. And what's keeping us from discovering the diamond? It's all the obscurations, all the mud. Here, another metaphor that's often used is that our true nature, our innate wisdom, I mean, it's not... Again, wisdom isn't something that you have to construct or collect or something like that. What we have to do is clear away the obstacles to what's already there. So we have this kind of innate wisdom, which is sometimes likened to the clear blue sky. We saw some clear blue sky today, didn't we? Yeah. It was 5 minutes in the afternoon, we saw some. And the rest of the day mostly was cloud cover. Now, when the clouds cover the clear blue sky, does the clear blue sky go away somewhere? Does it disappear? No. It's there all the time. It's always there, but we can't see it because the clouds are covering it. And clouds, by the way, the metaphor is a useful one. The clouds are what they call, in English, adventitious. Hardly ever get to use a big word like that. You know what it means? Adventitious. It means it's just they're just coming and going. You're right. They blow through the sky. They're not permanently fixed up there, you know, as obscurations. So the obscurations are adventitious. They come and go. They're impermanent. They're passing, just passing. So the problem when it comes to wisdom is that we get attached to the clouds, and we say, you know, the clouds are the sky. Are you following me in this metaphor? Has we gotten too deep into the metaphor? It's still a metaphor, okay? So we think that the clouds are the sky, and we are unaware of the clear blue sky that is above the cloud cover. So wisdom, another way of thinking about wisdom, is clearing out the clouds so that we can see the clear blue sky. All right, so obscurations will not be destroyed without the yoga of the perfection of wisdom, which is another way of saying what I said, Shanti Deva said in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Wisdom's everything. All this other stuff is very, very useful and preparatory. But without the yoga of the perfection of wisdom, the obscurations will not be cleared away. And so, in order to remove the mental affliction obstacles and the obstacles to wisdom, the practitioner should always meditate on the perfection of wisdom and practice skillful means, upaya, skillful means. So, another way to describe the whole path at this level is in terms of the two wings. The path has to have two wings, like a bird has two wings, right? Without both the wings, you're just going to like fly around in circles, right? With one wing, you just kind of go around in circles. So both wings have to be there. So one wing is called the compassion wing, or skillful means. Skillful means means all the things that you do to try to be a good person. To try to be a good person in life. And that's necessary. But the other wing also has to be there, and that's the wing of wisdom, understanding how the world works. So the practitioner should always meditate on the perfection of wisdom and practice skillful means. Meditating on the perfection of wisdom and practicing being a good person, a compassionate person, a loving person, a selfless person. That's all upaya. That's all skillful means, practice. But then you should meditate on the perfection of wisdom. Bondage, bandha, as in mukha bandha asana. Remember that asana that I taught you guys last night? Yeah. Did you try it yet? What does mukha mean? Mouth. Bandha. Come on, this is what you're supposed to do when the irritating person starts being irritating. You say, I'm a yogi, I got to do yoga. What's your yoga? Well, I'm going to do an asana called mukha bandha. Mukha means mouth. Bandha means you shut it. Bandha, bondage. If you're in Iyengar yoga, you can have assisted mukha bandha asana. Or you can put belts on it or something. Bondage is said to come from wisdom without skillful means, or skillful means without wisdom. That both keeps you in bondage, what he calls bondage, samsara. So without both the wings, you will remain in bondage. And so one cannot do without both. In order to remove doubts about what wisdom and skillful means are, I will clarify the real differences between the two. According to the words of the conquerors, that always means the Buddhas, skillful means includes all meritorious spiritual practices, beginning with the perfection of giving, up to but excluding the perfection of wisdom. So what does that mean? The first five perfections. First five perfections here are defined as skillful means, upaya. So that's one half of the practice. Then the whole other half of the practice is the six perfections. Sixth perfection, right? So that's how the pie is divided at this point. See how important wisdom is? Yeah. One who meditates on wisdom while keeping himself under control through the practice of skillful means. So that's kind of another interesting way of like talking about the two. Skillful means keeps you under control. And then meditation on wisdom is possible. Quickly attains awakening. Not someone who only meditates on the absence of a truly existing self. So here he's defining wisdom as a higher level of wisdom than the mere wisdom of understanding no self, what they call no self, which is really located at the step shared with those of medium scope. It's because understanding no self that you can get to nirvana. It's by understanding something more than that, which we'll be talking about, that you get to full awakening. So the absence of a truly existing self, a me. So then he says in the next verse, he actually talks about the absence of a true self. So he kind of like reels it back a little bit and says, but you still have to understand the absence of a truly existing self before you can understand the absence of a truly existing world. Okay? So me and mine. The self and phenomena are the two sort of arenas of what they call emptiness. There's an emptiness of me. I do not have the self I think I have. But nothing in my world has the kind of essential nature that I think it has either. So he starts with the me, the absence of a true self. Realizing that things are empty of having any inherent nature, any svabhava, what's called svabhava, inherent nature, that the five heaps that make up a person, the six senses and the objects of the senses, and did I say the five elements in the translation? Yes? That's incorrect, actually. It's 18, should be 18. I didn't count them right. I'll explain this in a second. Realizing that things are empty of having any inherent nature, blah, 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 that they do not arise on their own. This is said to be wisdom. So what are the five heaps? The five heaps of a person that makes up a person. These are called the skandhas in Sanskrit. This is on the basis of these five things we impute a self. You know what that means? Impute. Project. Okay? On the basis of our physical form. Our bodies, right? Are you your body? Do we ever identify with the body? All the time, right? But if you were your body, that would be like, you wouldn't need a mind, right? If you were just your body. If you were your body, you would need a mind. So there's the mind, there's the body, and then there's four main parts of the mind, basically. Four main kind of groupings or classifications of the mind. Number one, there's feelings, right? Feelings. Like that Barry Manilow song, feelings, nothing but feelings. Isn't that Barry Manilow? There's feelings. There is consciousnesses. Okay, we sometimes only use it in the singular. But there's not only consciousness of your thinking, but there's consciousness of what you see, consciousness of what you hear, consciousness of what you smell, consciousness of what you touch and what you taste. So that makes six consciousnesses. Okay? So that's the second part of the four parts of the mind. There's one part of the body. There's five altogether. One part of the body, then four of the mind. Feelings, consciousnesses, the discriminations, the ability to discriminate between physical objects, between visual objects. Between this chair and that chair. The ability to discriminate between sounds. The sounds of my voice and the sounds of a kookaburra. The ability to discriminate between different kinds of smells. The ability to discriminate between different tactile sensations. And what am I missing? Tastes. The ability to discriminate between kale and food. For example. Oh, and then one more part of the mind, okay? So you following all this? They're what they call the five heaps or aggregates or collections on the basis of which we say there's a me somewhere. See? So we've got our bodies, we've got our physical bodies, we've got feelings, we've got consciousnesses, we've got discriminations, and then there's this weird category called sanskaras, which can be translated as mental imprints. You could think of them just in shorthand as memories. Memories, right? It's very interesting. Like, I've been thinking a lot about this. Who would you be if you didn't have memory? You see? You could argue that we don't have memories. We are our memories, right? We don't have, you know, consciousnesses. We are our consciousnesses. We don't have discriminations. We are these things, right? We don't have a body. So, who's the I that has a body and mind? Okay? So this is a down and dirty entry-level emptiness meditation, okay? If there were an I like I think that there's an I, so first we have to get in touch with the I that we think we have. So the I that we, I just, and, you know, this is a long-term process in meditation. So I'll cut to the chase. The I that we think we have is an unchanging I. An I that somehow extends through our whole physical, you know, lifetime unchanged. The I that I was when I was 3 years old somehow manages to be the I that I am now. Right? We have a sense of that, isn't it? Yeah. Then there's the I that exists...
Unitary.
A unitary I. When we say I, we're not talking about a whole bunch of different people in there, are we? You know, if you're not Sybil, who is she? Wasn't she the one with multiple personalities? Like 100 different personalities or something like that? But when we say I, we mean there's one I, right? Singular, unitary I, unchanging I. And then also independent. Independent is the I that has a body and mind, but isn't the body and mind. See, independent of the body and mind, that has a body and mind. You get it so far? So we're going to go looking for that I. This is, in my book, Be Nobody, I use the example of where's Wally? You know where's Wally?
Yeah.
That little guy with the funny scarf and everything. He's always in like a crowd, huge crowd of people, and you like spend hours trying to find where Wally is, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to try to find our own personal Wally. If there's an I like I think that I have, it's either somewhere within the body-mind complex or apart from the body-mind complex. Right? So far? Right? Okay. It's either findable somewhere in here, body-mind complex, or it has to be somewhere else. Those are the only two options, isn't it? Inside or outside. So if there were an unchanging I, could it possibly be in the body-mind complex somewhere? Let's check. Is there any part of your body that's unchanging? Come on. No, right? Body's changing moment to moment. You get a whole new cellular structure every 7 years, they say, right? And it's not like 6 years and 350 some days go by and then they deliver you a new cellular structure. It's happening moment by moment, right? Change in your physical body. So there can't be an unchanging self if it is the body. So what about the mind? Maybe it's in the mind somewhere. Is there any part of the mind that's unchanging? What about your feelings? Are they changing or unchanging? What about your discriminations between things, changing or unchanging? Consciousnesses. What about any part of it? What about memories? Are memories changing or unchanging? They're constantly changing, aren't they? Every time you remember something, you change it a little bit. Isn't it? Yeah. So how can there be an unchanging self if it's in the body-mind complex? Where is the unchangingness of me if I am my body and mind? What about a... unitary self. Could that be in the body and mind somewhere? Is the body one thing or many things? You say many? How many bodies you got? No, it's one thing, isn't it? Okay, now we're getting into a little bit of the deep end here, okay? How could it be one thing and many things at the same time? Okay? If the body were really there, in the way that we think it's really there, objectively there, it would have to be one or many. See, there's no alternative. One or many. One or several, right? Those are two different things, two mutually exclusive options. So which is it, one or many? How many parts does it have?
Many.
So it's many.
No.
But how many bodies are there? See, and there you go. There's the tennis game. The tennis game, boom, ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. It can't be both one and many, logically, okay? Cannot be. Those are mutually exclusive options. So which is it, one or many? The answer is both, okay? But that's impossible if the body existed the way we think it does. The body can exist as both only because we have different perspectives on it. We can see it as one thing when we see it one way. We can see it as many things when we see it another way. Isn't it? But if it were really out there somehow, it would have to be either one or many. Got it? So let's just say, for now, we're still trying to find Wally, right? So If there was a unitary self somewhere that's identified with my body, how could my body have so many parts? You know, just take the hand, for example. Does the hand have parts? This hand. The left hand. Does the hand? Yeah, it's got five fingers. What about the finger here? Does it have parts? Yeah, it's got the part below the knuckle. It's got the knuckle. It's got the part above the knuckle. It's got that other knuckle, higher knuckle. What do you call that, Dr. Ian? The upper...
Distal.
Yeah, the upper distal... Whatchamacallit? It's got the fingernail. See, it's got a bunch of parts. What about the fingernail part? Does it, the fingernail, have parts? Yeah, it's got the, you know, right side, left side, top side, bottom side. What about the top side of the fingernail? Does the top side of the fingernail have parts? See, this is another kind of a plunge. There's no part that isn't further divisible into its parts. That's what we mean by a part. A part is something that minimally has a top side, bottom side, right side, left side, front side, back side. Without parts to a part, there wouldn't be a part. See what I mean? And every part of a part has its parts in order to be a part. And there's no partless parts. Down you go. Infinitely. Ad infinitum. Okay, logically, there cannot be... What would a partless part look like? A part that didn't have a right side, a left side, a top side, a bottom side, a front side, a back side. What would that look like? It would be inconceivable, right? You couldn't even think it, because it would be everything, right? So when you start looking for the parts of the parts of the parts in the body, it's infinite. So the body has infinite parts. How can there be a unitary self in a body that has infinite parts? Okay, what about in the mind? Does the mind have parts or not? Are there different parts of the mind? So where's the unitary self in the mind? So there can't be an unchanging self. Oh, did we do the unchanging yet? Yeah, everything's changing. Can't be an unchanging self, can't be a unitary self. So that only leaves the third option, an independent self, which means a self that exists apart from the body and mind. So there's a self over here that then has a body and mind. No, when we say that, don't we? When we're not thinking, when you're not like being, you know, forced to have to think about these things, we say, I have a body, right? I have memories. I have feelings. Well, who's the I that has a body and mind, right? It's like saying the room has four walls. Actually, it has more than four, but you see what I mean? A room has four walls, but where's the room that has four walls? See, what we call room is just an empty space that's enclosed by four walls, isn't it? It's not a thing. And the self is just like that. The self depends on the body and mind, but it isn't the body and mind, and it isn't apart from the body and mind either. So really, you can say it's an illusion. It's just an idea. We don't have a self. There isn't a self that has a body and mind. There isn't a self that is a body and mind. There's only an imaginary self. And that's the emptiness of self. Okay? So, I mean, you know, let's reel it back a little because everyone's getting freaked out already. Don't worry, you have a self, okay? You just don't have the self that you thought you had. Okay? It's not a thing. The self isn't a thing. It's an idea. So why? Here's a kind of an interesting question. Why do we have the idea of the self that we do? We all have different ideas of ourselves, right? I'm presumably. Don't really know what your idea of yourself is, but I know what my idea of myself is. Why do we have the, and if the self is only an idea, why do we have the particular kind of idea that we have about ourselves? And that's where you can kind of go back to memory. We are who we think we once were. But it's all just imagination. It's all just thought. It's all just imaginary. It isn't a thing. So let's move on. That's just the beginning. That's entry level. You guys getting ready for the hard stuff yet? Yeah. So realizing that things are empty of having any inherent, that five heaps that make up the person. And then he goes into the six senses and objects of the senses and the 18 elements, which are the six senses, six objects of the senses, and six consciousnesses of the senses. The 18 elements. So they don't really arise on their own. So there's no self. Then he goes into, there's no existing thing. So now he's talking about not just the self, but everything in the world. There's no existing thing that could be produced. And there is no non-existing thing, like a sky flower. This is like a typical example in these texts. A flower that could just grow in midair, could just pop up in midair. It's called a sky flower. That could be produced. To say something could be both existing and non-existing involves faulty reasoning. And so both of them together cannot be produced. All right, this is the first of what they call four great proofs of emptiness. This is the emptiness of phenomena. So we already covered the emptiness of persons or the emptiness of me. Now he's going to go into four different proofs of the emptiness of things, phenomena. The first one is this one that we're at now, 49, is called the emptiness of effects. Effects. So effects and causes. The next one is going to be causes. Causality is one of the ways that we, that is one of the main ways that we try to make sense of the world, isn't it? Try to make sense of the world through cause and effect. Cause and effect cannot exist the way we think it does. Okay, so he's starting with effects. Things that are produced means effects. There is no existing thing that could be produced. Why not? He just states it baldly, but it's actually kind of like obvious. If something exists, it doesn't need to be produced. An existing thing already exists. Okay, there's two kinds of things in the world possible, right? Existing things and non-existing things. Is there anything in between those two? Come on. Come on. It's not going to go on forever. You know, you've got about 45 minutes left to do some work here. You know, think. Is there something else besides existing things and non-existing things? All right, so existing things can't be produced. Why not? Already there. You don't need to produce an existing thing. And then what about non-existing things? Could they be produced? Why not? They don't exist. Okay? You can throw all kinds of causes at non-existing things, and they won't become existing things. If they're non-existing things, they don't exist. So existing things don't need to be produced, and non-existing things don't be produced. And then he says, you know, just to cover all bases. And something, to say something could be both existing and non-existing involves faulty reasoning. In other words, it's absurd. To say that mutually contradictory things could somehow exist at the same time. Okay, you following this? If it exists, it already exists. You don't have to produce it. If it doesn't exist, you could never produce it. It's like saying that you could somehow produce a unicorn. Okay, do unicorns exist or not exist? They do not exist, okay? They exist only as an idea. No, I mean, you could mate goats and horses as much as you want. You're never going to get a unicorn. You can't produce a unicorn because it doesn't exist. Okay? So you can't produce a non-existing thing, and you don't need to produce an existing thing because it already exists. Uh-huh. All right, here's another one. Here's another version of it. This is an old example. Sprouts come from seeds, right? Sprouts are the product of seeds, right? You have a seed, and then it produces a sprout. It seems to produce a sprout. That's what it seems. When does the seed end and the sprout begin? Can you find the exact moment where the seed stops being a seed and the sprout starts being a sprout? No, you can't. Every moment is... Oh, okay. back down. Just like every physical thing is infinitely divisible into its parts, No part that doesn't can't be reduced to its parts. We already did that one, right? Time is just like that too. There's no moment that can't be reduced or divided into its parts either. What we mean by a moment is something that has a beginning, middle, and end, right? That's a moment. So let's say we're trying to find the moment where the seed stops and the sprout begins. Well, let's say it's that moment. Well, that moment has a beginning, middle, and end. What about the beginning of that moment? Does it have a beginning, middle, and end? To say it is a beginning of a moment, it must have a beginning, middle, and end also. What about the beginning of that moment? Does it have a beginning, middle, and end? And down we go. So there's no findable time when anything begins. Or anything ends, for that matter. See, there's no absolute findable time when things end and other things begin. You understand that? There's no findable place where this stage ends and empty space begins. Because every physical thing can be divided further into its parts. It has a backside, front side, left side, right side, top side, bottom side. And every part of time is like that too. That's what we mean by a moment. A moment is made up of a beginning, middle, and end. And when we say beginning of a moment, we mean a moment, a beginning of a moment that itself has a beginning, middle, and end. That's why it's the beginning of a moment. See? And what about the beginning of the beginning of the moment? Shall I do it again? Yeah. You get it now? Things can't exist the way they seem to. They can only exist in a dreamlike fashion. Okay? I'll remind you of the conclusion here. The whole point of this exercise isn't to like blow your mind or like freak you out or something like that, but simply to take the rug out of the certainty that you have that the mere appearances of things are the way they are. They can't actually be that way. They can only have this kind of illusory or dreamlike existence. All right, that's the first of the four proofs of emptiness. Second one is on the emptiness of causes. An existing thing cannot come from itself, or from something other than itself, or from both itself and something other, and it is not without cause. Therefore, the true nature of existing things is that there is an absence of inherent nature to them. Emptiness again. All right, existing thing cannot come from itself. So now we're talking about causes. Are things caused? So the answer to that is, it seems like it. So then we say, well, how are they caused? Do they come from themselves? Do the glasses come from the glasses themselves? So, no. Right? No. If glasses came from themselves, they would be endlessly replicating. If things came from themselves, they would endlessly replicate. So that means they must come from something other than themselves. Right? Same as, different than. Is there anything in between those two? Same as, different than. Is there a middle ground between those two? So if they're not the same as, if the glasses don't come from glasses, then they must come from something different than glasses. Yes? So how could glasses come from something that's not glasses?
Glasses is just the name.
Well, that's true. That's true, but everything's just a name, isn't it? I mean, these we call glasses, but if you had never seen glasses, you would give them a different name. Maybe you'd give them fire starter, for example. See? That's another way of talking about the fact that things don't exist the way we think they do. These do not have any essential nature of being glasses. They exist as glasses because we think of them and call them glasses. If we thought of them and called them something else, they would be that. Fire starter, right? Put them in the sun and maybe they could start a fire. Same as, different than. So if the cause of things isn't the same as themselves, then it must come from something different than themselves, which is totally illogical. Can oranges come from apples, come from oranges? See, apples and oranges are different things, aren't they? So how could apples come from oranges? How could things come from something different than themselves? See? They can't come from themselves. They can't come from something different than themselves. They can't come from both themselves and something different than themselves, because those are mutually exclusive categories. And then he says also, but they don't happen for no reason either. They don't happen causelessly either. So in other words, we're eliminating all logical possibilities of how things could be caused. What are you left with when you eliminate all possible logical possibilities for causality? What are you left with? Empty-handed. I don't know. You can say, I don't know. That's your mantra for tonight. I don't know. Only in a dreamlike fashion. I don't know how the magic works. It's a magic trick, and I don't know how it works. But it can't work the way I think it does. Third proof. Moreover, when we examine all existing things to see if they are singular or plural, we can find no true nature as either. So we already did this one. This is called the emptiness of things existing as one or many. I did a whole retreat on this one time. I went to Ireland, I hired a cottage, and I sat there for 3 weeks with a Buddha statue in front of me. So imagine this is a Buddha statue. And four or five times a day, would sit down for like maybe a half hour, 45 minutes, and just meditate on, this is the entirety of this meditation. We're imagining this as a Buddha statue, right? Is the Buddha statue in front of me one thing or many things? If it were out there, like we think everything is, right? We think everything is out there on its own, independently, objectively existing. If things existed that way, we would have to be able to say whether they were singular or plural, because those are mutually exclusive categories. Right? If they were out there, they couldn't be both somehow. So then you say, well, it's one thing, I think. You know, because there's only one statue there. But look how it's got a head, it's got a torso, it's got legs, it's got arms. Well, that's many things. But wait, it can't be many things because there's only one statue there. Yeah, but the statue's got so many parts to it, so it must be many things. No, but there's only one Buddha statue. And back and forth and back and forth. That's the entirety of that meditation. I highly recommend it. No, I mean, after several weeks, you know, you finally get some inkling that there could never be a Buddha statue out there. Impossible. The Buddha statue isn't out there. It's in my mind. It can only be both singular and plural because I'm seeing it from two different perspectives. I'm making it singular at one time and making it plural at another time. It's not either singular or plural out there on its own. Okay? Depends on me how I see it. And that's a pretty big insight because it's not just Buddha statues that exist like that either. Okay? Here's another one. Here's one of my favorite ones. This is a little bit off-road. It's not in the text. Let's use the glasses again, okay? This is a visible object, right? Visible object. Everyone see it? There's no one blind here. So everyone's seeing a visible object here, right? If we all left the room, would there be a visible object here? No, come on. If I put them down and said, all right, everyone out, everyone go look at the kangaroos outside, would there still be a visible object here?
Is that the scientific theory as, like, you aren't the aggravator if there's an aggravator?
Yeah, it's the same principle. Exactly. So, you know, unless you're already tipped off, you know, you'd say, of course there's a visible object there. If everyone left the room, the glasses would still be there as a visible object, waiting to be seen by someone. Right? There's no visible object without a seer of the visible object. That's what makes it a visible object. If there were a visible object that existed independently of the seer who sees the visible object, it would be an invisible visible object. Right? Because it's not being seen. That means invisible. So the visible object depends on the seer for it to be a visible object. Everyone all right so far? And the seer, what about the seer? Is there a seer who exists before a visible object that the seer sees? That would be an independently existing seer who says, I'm a seer, I don't see nothing. You know, but soon I'll see. I'm a seer who will soon see. Huh, you see, impossible, right? Illogical. So the seer depends on the visible object just like the visible object depends on the seer. Right? There's no visible object without a seer. There's no seer of visible objects until unless there's a visible object to see. Okay? So far? Neither can exist without the other. Okay? So there is no visible object until and unless a seer sees the visible object. And there's no seer until and unless there's a visible object that the seer is seeing. Neither can exist without the other. Now here's the kicker, okay? This is the one that you have to put in your pipe and smoke for a while to understand what they're talking about when they say it's only a dreamlike existence. Neither one can come first. Neither one can come first. Impossible. See? So what kind of reality is that? Where visible objects and seers of visible objects exist in an interdependent, mutually dependent fashion. And it's not just visible. You can do it with all six senses, including the mental sense. No sound, no audible sound until and unless there's a hearer who hears the audible sound. Yes or no? You know that big like question that you used to argue about? Like did the, or maybe you didn't. If a tree fell in the woods and there was no one there to hear it, would it make a sound? The answer to that's quite simple. Of course not. If there's no one there to hear it, in what sense is it audible? In what sense does it make a sound? It's absurd to say it makes a sound that no one heard. See, that makes no sense whatsoever. Everything exists that way. And nothing exists apart from that. Okay? And that's emptiness. Emptiness means that everything is empty of existing independently. And everything exists mutually dependently. Mutually interdependently. Not dependently either, okay? You can't say, that's not accurate to say things exist dependently. Why not? You could say, the sprout depends on the seed, right? Yeah, because neither one can come first. So if you say that something depends on something else that the something depends on has to be there before the something else that, you know what I mean? I got confused there for a second. So the seed actually isn't the cause of the sprout until and unless there's a sprout. So, you know, when we say which comes first, the cause or the effect? Well, the effect can't come first. That's absurd. To say an effect comes before a cause. The sprout can't come before the seed, right? But neither can the cause come until and unless there's an effect. Cause and effect exist in the same way everything else does, in a mutually dependent fashion. And that kind of, if you think about this, that should throw you for a loop a little bit. Logically, you can sort of, you know, this is all logic. This is all using your brain, you know? Not asking you to believe in anything magical or mystical. But by using logic, you can uncover, you can undermine our faith in what we think. Using just reasoning, you can undermine your faith in the mere appearances of things, how we think things work. They cannot work the way we think they do. All right, the last proof here is the fourth one. It's just kind of like mentioned. It is explained in texts like Nagarjuna's 70 verses on emptiness and the root verses on the middle way that the only inherent nature existing things have is found in their emptiness. So inherent nature is a svabhava. This means that things have no independent essences. An independent essence, for example, of a visible object, independent essence, would be it could exist as a visible object without a seer seeing it, because it would have some independent nature or essence to it. But that's impossible, right? Here's a more practical version. Does the irritating person in your life exist essentially as an irritating person. And, you know, until we actually think about it, of course we think. Of course they do. Obviously. They're obviously irritating, right? Obviously. But when you stop to think about it, how could they be irritating all by themselves? See, number one, everyone would find them irritating if they had that as their essence. The essence d'irritation. Okay? If they, things had essences, self-nature, that means essence. If they had an essence, then they would be what they are, regardless of who saw them, right? They would be what they are. So an irritating person who existed essentially as an irritating person, everyone would find irritating, without exception, except for crazy people, you know, because they wouldn't be seeing them properly, because they were essentially irritating. Furthermore, if an irritating person existed essentially as an irritating person, they would be always irritating in exactly the same way. They would be like flatline irritating. They would never kind of be more irritating or less irritating, because that would be their essential nature, to be irritating. Wouldn't change, right? Even you know, our own most irritating people, sometimes we find them more irritating, sometimes less irritating, right? Fluctuates. Sometimes we don't find them irritating at all. As long as they don't open their mouth or something like that, they're not irritating. But if they were an irritating person, essentially, they would always be irritating. So that things don't have essences like that. Things do not exist that way. They do exist in relationship. So we'll do it again, okay? No irritating person until and unless what? You're irritated. Okay? They depend on you to be irritated for them to be irritating. And you depend on them to be irritating for you to be irritated. Neither can exist without the other. Irritating, irritated, neither can come first. Same formula over and over and over again. And that's how things exist. And they do not exist in any other way than that. And that's emptiness. Okay? The emptiness is the absence of them existing in any other way than in a mutually dependent relationship. Okay, you've got the full download tonight. In order to not make this tome too weighty, in order not to make this class too heavy, we will not go into the particulars here. Yeah, only the final conclusions. So a meditation on the lack of essence to things, where one cannot find an inherent nature in anything, is a wisdom meditation. So we just did like maybe 6, 7, 8. Possible wisdom meditations tonight. And of course, they're not meditations until you actually meditate on them. Right? They're just like jibber jabber so far. So you take those home, any one of those, and like work on it, like over and over and over again until you start getting the, what they call in Sanskrit, rasa, the flavor, the juice from that meditation. And then it starts to change you a little bit. Having used wisdom to intellectually examine all things, so all of this has just been intellectual so far, and finding no inherent nature in them, one should then meditate on wisdom in a non-conceptual way. And I think since I already did the irritating person thing so many times, we'll do a non-conceptual meditation tomorrow morning. Non-conceptual emptiness meditation. So non-conceptual means not mediated by thought, by concepts. You could argue, it has been argued very strongly, that we do not see the world as it is. We see the world through only our concepts of what we think it is. Yeah. Everything's mediated through our ideas of things, our concepts of things, which is directly related to language. So sometimes they name and form. We name things as glasses because we have a concept of glasses, because we have a language, we have a name in our language, glasses. So that we see them because we have the concept and linguistic name for the things that we see in the world. We're not seeing the things in the world, we're seeing our concepts of the things in the world. So to try to get to the non-conceptual state also means a direct and unmediated relationship with reality around us. This world has come into being. This one you could cut out and put on your fridge. This is a really sort of powerful stanza here. This world has come into being through concepts and thus exists purely conceptually. The abandonment of all such conceptual thinking is the highest nirvana. Stop thinking. Stop mediating the world through your ideas about the world and get in touch with the world, and that's the highest nirvana. And so the Lord has said, conceptual thinking entails great ignorance and casts us into the ocean of samsara. When one stays in perfect non-conceptual meditation, the space-like non-conceptual state appears clearly. Ka vat, ka means space, vat means like that. The space-like nirvikalpa, non-conceptual state, appears clearly. It is also said in the mystical verses on entering the non-conceptual state, when the bodhisattvas think non-conceptually about this highest teaching, they will transcend the conceptuality which is so hard to get beyond. Is it hard to get beyond conceptuality? Yeah, it's really hard to get beyond conceptuality and still be conscious. We get beyond conceptuality like every night when we go to sleep. This is why we like sleep so much, because we don't have to think in sleep. Yeah, we're relieved of the burden of having to think about stuff all the time. And so we long for that. We long for ecstatic states for the same reason. We're drawn to orgasm because we don't... If you're thinking during orgasm, you're not having an orgasm. Okay? You know, if you're like, I am having an orgasm. You see, you lose yourself, right? You lose your conceptual mind. And these are the highest... These are the times of our highest happiness, actually, highest bliss. So if we could do that in a conscious, sort of directed way, then you get some taste of what they're talking about enlightenment, about awakening. Losing the conceptual, losing the prison house of conceptuality. Yeah, gradually they will arrive at the state of non-conceptuality. And so, having ascertained through reasoning and scriptural authority that all things are unproduced and without an inherent nature. So, you know, having worked that out intellectually and through guidance through the text, one should meditate in a non-conceptual manner. Meditating in this way, one gradually obtains the stages of the path of preparation. Some of you know that path of preparation precedes the path of seeing, which means seeing reality directly, known as heat and the rest. So you get gradually deeper intellectual understandings of how reality really is, then as a kind of a prelude to the direct perception of how reality really is, which is non-conceptual. One then attains the 10 stages of a bodhisattva, beginning with joy. This is a reference to the 10 bodhisattva grounds or stages, and soon thereafter, the awakening of a Buddha. So he's pointing the way now to the, you know, kind of end. There's a last section here on the last part of the stages of the spiritual path according to this system, and it's on Tantra, the way of the diamond. And I'll let you read it yourself. I translated it. It's in the text. It's open. But because it's esoteric material, we won't go into it publicly here. But pretty much every spiritual path has an esoteric component to it. Kabbalah in Judaism, Christian mysticism, or initiatory kinds of cults in the Christian tradition, and in Islam, you know, the Sufi tradition is kind of this order. And these are dimensions of the path that are meant to speed up the process. The process has already been laid out. We finished the process. We finished the A to Z. But then the Tantra, you know, in this tradition and in the Hindu tradition, is also meant to juice the engine, to make it move quicker. And that's the case also in the mystical traditions, Kabbalah and so forth. So that's it. It wasn't so bad, was it? Yeah? It wasn't so bad. Now you can all rest and stop thinking and go into a non-conceptual state. All right, thanks for working hard. It's hard to understand. It's hard to get it, especially if it's like your first time around or your 10th time around, or maybe your 30th. by about the 500th time around, you start to get a little bit. The jumper starts to unravel a little easier. Yeah. Things cannot exist the way they seem to. Cannot.